This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with the Parks and Recreation Superintendent for the Town of Highland, Alex Brown. The Town of Highland is putting a question up on the November 6th general election ballot for residents to consider for expansion of the Lincoln's Community Center expansion project. We'll find out more about the project and what voters are being sought for. Later, Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne will join us to talk about this past weekend's decision to put Brett Kavanaugh on the U.S. Supreme Court and its impact on Hoosier politics. And we'll also talk, too, about some of the midterm elections coming up and comments as well, too, about the upcoming senatorial debate. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The general election ballot public question number one reads as follows, in part, shall the Park District of the Town of Highland issue bonds or enter into a lease to finance the 2018 Lincoln Center expansion project? And then it goes on for more information. That is what voters and residents in the Town of Highland will see when they go to the polls on November 6th in the general election. Is talking about plans for an expansion project at the Lincoln Center. And with us to talk more about the not only the expansion project itself, but also about the referendum question, is Superintendent of Parks and Recreation in the Town of Highland, Alex Brown. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, let's go into detail first about what the project is all about. And how it all got started with, I guess, the master plan that's come out here. And maybe we should just briefly, before we even go into that, talk a little bit about Lincoln Center. There are folks maybe listening that are not familiar with a very beautiful recreational center that's built up there in the old Lincoln School area.
Well, the Lincoln Community Center at one point was the old Lincoln School in Highland. And when the school town closed that school back in the early to mid-1980s, the town saw a need to have a community center, so the town took over the operations of the old Lincoln School and turned it into the Lincoln Community Center. And through time, in 1998, we added a 36,000-square-foot athletic field house onto the back of the building. And then over time, the old Lincoln School just really started to show its age. It was starting to have some problems, so the park board, around 2008, was looking at either rebuilding the Lincoln Community Center or rehabbing it. Through talks with lots of different architects and engineers, they didn't see the purpose of keeping most of it. It was in such bad shape that it came time then to talk about tearing down the old Lincoln School and rebuilding the Lincoln Community Center. So in 2008, we commissioned Dewberry Architects to do a building master plan for it, so we knew, you know, where we could go or where we wanted to go in the future. And at that time we rehabbed. So in 2010 we decided to redo the Lincoln Center, but as part of the building master plan in 2008 there was a phase two that we decided, you know, could be done at a future date, and that was adding an indoor turf field house onto the Lincoln Center. So in 2008 we decided where we could leave room for that building, and then in 2010 we decided it wasn't that time to do it, but in the future we could do that. So in early 2018, the park board was given permission by the town council to move ahead with phase two of the project.
Now, how busy would you say, if that's really the word to use for the Lincoln Center itself, I guess how busy, how often is it used? How many organizations roughly get the chance to use the facilities on a daily basis or a weekly basis there in Highland?
Oh, there's thousands of people that come through the building every week. We're open at 5 a.m. in the morning for our fitness center, opens at 5 a.m. And on most weekdays, we're open until 10 o'clock at night. So, I mean, the field house gets a lot of use, all the classrooms with our classes that we offer, a lot of rentals that in the evening that different community organizations are using, people renting out rooms on weekends for baby showers, birthdays, graduation parties, retirement parties, what have you. And then obviously lots of the tournaments and leagues and stuff that we hold in the field house just brings lots of people through the Lincoln Community Center. There's also a daycare in the building that has about 90 kids that, you know, parents that have to have daycare for their children. Well, while both of them work.
Now, you have obviously on a big project like this that you're proposing, you have to have not only, of course, park board approval. You have your park board working with you on this. Also, you have to have the town council. Tell us what talks that they might have had or thoughts they may have expressed to you and to the rest of the park board members about what you were hoping to do in this expansion.
Well, a lot of those talks actually centered around how we were going to finance the project, and that's ultimately why we are going to referendum. For a town our size, a referendum of over $15 million kicks in a referendum having to happen. We're proposing that this project's going to be under $15 million, but the town council and the clerk treasurer, Michael Griffin, both on two counts decided to take this to referendum. One, that it would if a referendum is approved, it stays outside of the tax caps. The Department of Local Government Finance would say, you know, who are we to say you can't raise your taxes if it's approved on a voter referendum? So the one decision was we didn't want to affect any of our operating funds for this, so we wanted this to be outside of the tax cap. And two, the town council just really wanted to take it to the voters and have the voters decide if it was the facility that they wanted in this town. So the decision was made to voluntarily go to a referendum.
From what you've learned from Mr. Griffin and other people at the town council, how many times has the town of Highland had to go to a referendum, something like this or something similar?
Well, to my knowledge, this is the first referendum for such a project in Highland. I don't believe the school's even gone to a referendum.
Now, everybody's done their best to try to hang to the money that you have available. But as you say, with the tax caps there, you'll be hard-pressed to keep the operating budget going without having to have problems here if you try to add too many things to it, I would imagine.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, let's go into more detail about what is called for. You mentioned a little bit here about what the building's like now. What would you like the Lincoln Community Center to look like if the voters and property owners and the town of Highland approve?
Well, if the referendum passes, we plan on putting in an indoor turf facility, which would be just under the building itself would be just under 50,000 square feet. The plans then would include for 32,000 square feet of artificial turf. We'll also then, obviously, some of the other areas will include a lobby seating for 120 spectators, restrooms, and we've had some people wanting a physical therapy room here as part of our fitness center. We just didn't have the space to put such a room, so we are planning on putting a physical therapy room in also. And then, obviously, we'll have needs for some areas for storage and mechanical rooms. And we'll be adding 114 additional parking spaces to the parking lot outside to accommodate such a building.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that in this case, with so many things planned for this this building being enclosed and with artificial turf, that this will probably make things a lot easier, certainly for the school town of Highland? They have, of course, the football field, and they have the basketball court on hand already, and they keep it very busy during the school year. And I'm sure they probably would appreciate to bring in more sports as well, too, if they can fit in within the town of Highland.
Well, I'm not sure that the school town will use it as much as all the youth sports organizations in town that use it. Highland's got a very large soccer club. They've got over 650 kids playing youth soccer in Highland, and the Little League, Babe Ruth organizations, and the Highland Girls Softball organizations, and Highland Pop Warner are all the groups that we would envision using it quite a bit more than the high school would. I'm sure in terms of planning and stuff, the high school would have some uses for it.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's being proposed as a multi-use facility where we can do soccer in there, baseball, softball, and football. That would be for basically 8 to 9 months out of the year. In the summer months, when no one wants to be on an indoor turf facility, we're proposing putting down 6 wood basketball volleyball courts being laid down on top of the turf, which would enable us to offer a lot more basketball and volleyball leagues, tournaments, and open play in the summer.
We're talking to Town of Highland Parks and Recreation Superintendent Alex Brown about the proposed question that is going to be in the Town of Highland on the November 6th the election ballot about asking for a support for a major project of expansion for the Lincoln Community Center. And tell us now, Alex, in talking with the town officials and others, I'm sure, what information that you've received here, what kind of a tax impact will this have on the average homeowner in the town of Highland if they do agree to this?
Well, we do have a tax calculator up on our website that comes right from the Indiana Department of Local Government. And people can put in their EAV of their home on there, and it'll show them exactly what the tax impact will be. The average home EAV in Highland is $170,000. So putting in the that amount into the tax calculator shows a increase in their taxes of $787 a month, or about $94 annually.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've had a chance to talk with a lot of people, obviously, and explaining the project to them, and town council members, I'm sure, have done the same as well, too, when they had to take this up to make a decision to, in turn, go to a referendum vote here on the ballot this November 6th. What kind of reaction, comments have you gotten from residents of Highland to what you have planned here?
Well, it seems to be pretty split down the middle right now, actually. There's obviously a lot of people that don't want their taxes increased at all. And at the same time, there's people that see the value of, adding recreational opportunities and recreational facilities in the town to increase the quality of life in town.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that maybe in some cases those who are not supportive might be because they're longstanding residents, they have homes, many have retired, I'm sure, and probably don't feel they can afford the extra taxes?
Yes, and maybe they don't see how it's benefiting them at this point in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not having any children or seeing the impact that it could have on them.
And probably, too, then you've got the other side of the people that have youngsters, have young people, or folks who have not even gotten out of school yet, and they're involved in lots of sport activities, and they'll be able to take advantage of the expanded facilities in the building, too, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And Highland is doing very, very well right now in terms of its real estate market. Houses don't seem to last very long on the market here in Highland. They seem to sell fairly quickly. Just talking and reading stuff about the school town of Highland, their newsletter just came up, and their population in the schools just went up again for this year. So it seems to me that there are young families with young kids moving into Highland.
Now, if everything goes well, if the voters agree to the referenda and the additional taxes that they'll pay for this project, how soon do you hope to have the building expansion done and have sports activities going on in it?
Well, if it passes, we would go right into financing, and then we would actually then hire an architect to do actual design and civil engineers and mechanical engineers to design the building, going to permit and building, and then construction, which and all that will take anywhere from 22 to 24 months. So we would love to have an October of 2020 grand opening, which would just, re-rate when the winter months and the cold weather starting and in. We can start all those activities into a nice brand new indoor turf facility.
Now, it comes first, of course, with the public question that's on the Tuesday, November 6th, the general election ballot for residents in Highland, asking for the approval by the voters to allow for the additional taxes and other expenditures to get this Lincoln Community Center expansion project going. And we're talking with Alex Brown. He's the superintendent of the Town of Highland Parks and Rec Department. And Alex, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Corporations that give political contributions not only are likely to get a federal contract out of those contributions, but the contracts may be very, very advantageous to the firm. Now, that is according to a new study put out by Ball State University, and our next guest here on the program is going to tell us more about that. Reza Houston is a Ball State University finance professor, and he has worked with some researchers in a couple other universities around the country on what is being called a sweetheart index. And Reza Houston is with us today. Thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Tell us a little bit about what I guess the term sweetheart index is all about, and how did you and your colleagues from University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, and Florida Atlantic University had to come up with?
The sweetheart index really refers to this idea of a sweetheart contract, where the contract terms are really very lucrative to the firm that receives the contract. So my colleagues and I actually had this idea to create a sweetheart index to measure the quality of government contracts being received by government contractors. And we wanted to look at who actually receives these sweetheart contracts, these contracts that are, well, more lucrative. Mm-hmm. And so what we did was we looked at the relationship between contributions made by firm-affiliated PACs to candidates for federal office and the quality of future contracts that those firms receive. And what we find is this really positive relationship between the PAC contributions made by these firm-affiliated PACs and the quality of the sweetheart index, or the quality of the contracts that's being received. Mm-hmm. And the sweetheart index is really made up of four different characteristics. It ranges from 0 to 4, depending on which of these characteristics the individual contract exhibits. So whether it's a no-bid contract, whether it's a cost-plus versus fixed-fee contract, whether it's a long-term contract, and whether or not there's certain cost or pricing data required at the time of contract signing. So certain contracts exhibit all of these characteristics, whereas certain contracts exhibit none of them. So we actually identify, a couple of fairly significant relationships. Our overall result is that, yes, there is a positive relationship between PAC contributions and Sweetheart Index, but we also find that each of these individual characteristics of the Sweetheart Index, in particular, no-bid contracts or sole-source contracts and cost-plus contracts, we find a very positive relationship between PAC contributions of firms to candidates for public office and the likelihood that the contracts that they're receiving are no bid and cost plus. And obviously there's some potential endogeneity here, since a lot of these firms that are receiving these large government contracts are firms that operate in industries like the aviation industry or some other industry that's very tightly intertwined with the federal government. And so they're very likely making large PAC contributions. And so we actually had to run a number of endogeneity tests to control for this this relationship. And so we did a couple of different things. The first thing we did was look at what happens when a firm increases its PAC contributions to federal government employees. And what we found was that firms that increase their PAC contributions actually see an increase in the quality of the sweetheart, or in the sweetheart index of their government contracts over the next year or 2 years or even 3 years, although it diminishes after that. Next, we looked at what happens when a firm makes a contribution to a candidate for public office who then becomes the chair of a very powerful committee in the Senate or the House. So, for example, let's say, well, name a company that is a government contractor. Maybe I shouldn't. But let's say a company makes a contribution to a current senator who then, after the election, becomes the new chair of the Appropriations Committee. Mm-hmm. Well, what we're finding is that those firms that make those contributions and then have the candidates that they've contributed to become the chair of a very powerful committee, like the Appropriations Committee or the House, the Ways and Means Committee, those firms see the most significant increase in their sweetheart index of their various contracts. And then finally, what we did was we looked at the results of close elections and how firms that made contributions to candidates who were not quite who we weren't sure were going to win their re-election bid or any election bid, what happened as a result of those PAC contributions. And so it's really what we have there is an exogenous shock where after the election, that candidate wins office, and we can look at, well, really what happens with a free hand, so to speak. And what we're finding in that test is that firms that make campaign contributions to candidates who win very close elections, they actually also see a significant increase in their quality of the contracts that they receive in the future. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned at the start of our conversation here that you and your colleagues in Colorado and in Florida had a chance to look over a number of contracts by various companies across the country, mainly dealing, as you say, in federal contracts. And you referred to like the aviation industry. Did you also have a chance to look at some information from like shipbuilding companies that might in turn be beneficial if they get the right kind of help on Capitol Hill that gets to contracts with the Navy for building ships or airplanes or something like that, or either any other types of procurement contractors like that?
Oh, absolutely. So what we have is a database of more or less all large government contracts provided by it's actually part of the federal procurement data system. Mm-hmm. And we matched contracts in that file to, firms that are publicly traded in the United States. And so we have this massive database of several million government contracts. Of course, the ones that actually exhibit these four variables that we can use to calculate the Sweetheart Index are the larger ones, contracts in excess of about 750,000. But these contracts are given out to firms in a variety of industries. It's not just aviation. It's not just shipbuilding. It could be pharmaceuticals even.
All right. Yeah.
We can look at contracts in just about every, given out by just about every agency in the government.
Yeah, for example, you were talking about pharmaceuticals. You're talking about companies that might possibly be wanting to get contracts with HHS or the Veterans Administration, especially for VA hospitals and clinics and things like that, and get yourself involved in that and in turn make some money and in turn some influence, I'm sure, at those particular areas. When you take a look at all this information together and the contracts, the importance of these people that have influence on the contracts, whether it's awarding them or, as you say, being members of appropriations committees and the like here, and how this all links together with political action campaigns that are out there, the PACs. And you talk about this political connectedness that seems to branch out even beyond making some kind of influence as a lobbyist. And like it goes into, I guess, even in hiring as well, too, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly it does. We actually, one of our variables in one of our later tests, and it's something I've used in some other papers, is a variable that indicates whether or not the firm has hired an individual who is a former politician or regulator to their board or management team. And so what we find is, in some cases, a positive relationship between the prior experience of these individuals or the hiring of these individuals and the quality of a firm's government contracts, although that really wasn't the focus of our paper.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that as we approach the midterm elections, and of course now with all of the atmosphere being as acrimonious as it is on Capitol Hill and in Washington, D.C., that the data that you all have come up with in putting this sweetheart deal piece together, so to speak, is even more important than maybe ever before?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're really just beginning to scratch the surface. And now that, given the current nature of politics, I think our work is probably going to be a little more important than it has been for the last several years.
We've been talking with Ball State University finance professor Reza Houston, who, along with colleagues working in research at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs and at Florida Atlantic University, which is in northern Florida, have worked together and put out what they're referring to as a Sweetheart Index. And by the way, if you'd like to find out more about this index, it's going to be published in an upcoming issue of a report which is called the Financial Review. It's a publication put out by the Eastern Finance Association, and I'm sure that if this gets enough airplay, so to speak, and reading in the print media, that I'm sure that they'll either have to put more issues out or they're going to have to make sure that it's available on their website, too, I would imagine. We'll see what happens to come out of this, I suppose. And thank you very much, Reza, for being with us to talk about this. And thanks for you and your colleagues in Colorado and Florida working on this research to find out more about the link between contracts that are offered by federal governments and how political contributions play a very big role in this in one way or the other, maybe more behind the scenes, but it sometimes in particular this time of year is more important. Thank you very much for spending time to talk with us about this.
Thanks again, Chris.
This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. NPR political editor Ron Elving is describing President Trump's choice of Brett Kavanaugh is already being the most contentious nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court since Clarence Thomas won confirmation vote in 1991. And even though there wasn't necessarily a racial element in the Kavanaugh controversy, it certainly is very bruising. Let's talk about the result in the vote in the Senate over the weekend and what maybe might be considered the Kavanaugh saga, and if it's going to leave any bruises behind, or will they be more permanent scars to the body politic. For that, returning to Andy Downs. He's the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. And as always, Andy, thanks for joining us on the program today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, had a chance to catch the observation of what happened over the weekend, the official confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we know that the very difficult time that the senators, I'm sure, had, and maybe if not on the floor of the Senate publicly, but probably in the cloakrooms to deal with all of this. What's your thought about what we happen to have heard and seen over the weekend?
I think a lot of people would point to someone like Susan Collins and say, how could she vote the way she voted on something like the Affordable Care Act and then turn around and behave in what they might perceive to be a different way when it comes to the confirmation vote? And I think we need to remember those are two very different votes. Something like the Affordable Care Act, although it could be in place and there for a long, long time, is also something that's subject to change by legislation the next year. And so there's a temporariness to it that you don't get when you're talking about something like a Supreme Court nomination because of the lifetime appointment and the sense of permanence for those who get them and obviously stay in the positions for a long time. I think they're also different because we're talking about different pressures coming from the leadership in the chamber. Mitch McConnell made it very clear early on that he was and has wanted to for a while make sure the composition of the courts, and that would be all the federal courts, complies with his vision of what the courts should do. And so I'm sure he probably put on more pressure for this than he did for something like the Affordable Care Act or to the tax cuts or other sorts of things. So, you know, the dynamics, I'm sure, were very different, at least inside the caucus room, for those who got to be inside the caucus room.
Now, we know in the past there's always been some kind of debate. As we say, it may not be public. It may be more private amongst the senators and themselves. But they always seem, at least in what you'd see on C-SPAN anyway, see something that was a bit more unified. And we know that there have been times where it's been hardly a love fest, I suppose, between the Democrats and the Republicans. But they typically would get along, I guess, certainly beyond what was actually done in the Senate chambers. But this seems to have changed that whole dynamic around, hasn't it?
Well, there certainly has been a growing tension over judicial appointments for many years now. This is not something that's unique to President Trump's time in office. This goes back, some would say, at least into the Obama years and probably even to the Bush years, depending on who you're asking. The fact that the cloture vote was reduced from two-thirds down to simple majority, those are signs that the two groups just were not getting along and not able to reach that consensus that a lot of people would think they were striving for, especially in something like a judicial court nomination. The dynamics have changed there, to say the least, and some say that this is a spillover from what's been happening from a legislative standpoint. We've simply now seen those disagreements spill over into things that used to be viewed as very nonpartisan. And if you think about it, Lindsey Graham, although you know a lot of people didn't like the way he said it, when he talked about Kagan and Sotomayor, he did what a lot of people considered to be the Senate's job, reviewed the qualifications of the individual, and then decided this person is qualified. I may not agree with her, but she is qualified, and therefore I will consent. And there are plenty of senators who've done that. In fact, I think if we were able to ask all of the Democrats when Kavanaugh's name was submitted, what do you think of this person? I think a fair number of them probably would have said, in that old school way of thinking, yeah, this is somebody who probably deserves a seat on the court from a qualification standpoint. But then as the process went on, certainly the way in which he carried himself, if not the accusations of sexual assault, gave people justification to say, no, this person is not for the court. This person is not exhibiting the right temperament to be a member of the court.
It also seemed, too, that the decision for the cloture vote on Friday came at a time which was also an anniversary of the Me Too movement. So you talk about going back to the problems of a year ago and how it was handled. And so I guess that just added even more fuel to the fire, did it not?
Yeah, no doubt it did. I'm sure the vote was scheduled for that moment because that was the fastest they could do it. I doubt they were thinking too much about the Me Too movement, though.
And the question, I guess, have come up, and as mentioned, too, and what I guess Ron Elving had talked about and wrote about as well for NPR, was talking about the role of the Federalist Society as far as choosing nominees for the U.S. Supreme Court. And certainly that was an idea that not only the Trump administration, but apparently even the Senate majority leader was thinking of when it was time to choose somebody. And that's, of course, how we end up with now with Justice Kavanaugh on the bench.
Yes, and actually, they keep in mind, they have a long list of individuals, longer than the 9 seats available in total, and they'll keep handing those names over. This was a promise, or I shouldn't say promise, it might be a little too strong a word, but this certainly was an agreement that the president came to, or an understanding the president came to with the Federalist Society. And there are other groups out there that would love to get into the same position. What makes an arrangement like this attractive, I think, is that as a president, you have an automatic stamp of approval from a particular ideological perspective. And so if what you're looking to do is put members who are of a particular ideological position, and that usually means either very liberal or very conservative, on the court, what a great arrangement. You know, I mean, you love to find an organization that has some legitimacy, that's viewed well by your ideological compatriots. And so you simply pick names off that list. They've probably vetted the people to some degree, which increases the likelihood you won't have something bad show up during the background checks that happen. I mean, it's a pretty sweet agreement. But if what you're looking for is somebody to help balance the court, you're not going to find too many groups running around that say, we're moderates and we're happy to come up with some names for you.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who's the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne. And we've been talking here about official nomination and official confirmation, rather, of Brett Kavanaugh as the next Supreme Court justice. Let's take a look at the impact on Hoosier politics now when it involves the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Democrat Joe Donnelly and his Republican challenger. I guess, and more in particular, the Republican challenger, who's the one who's been the most vocal, Mike Braun, about this. And we haven't heard much from Libertarian Lucy Brenton. We know we will hear very much from all three of them here in Westville this evening. But first, let's check in first on what kind of impact this is, decision and the new Supreme Court justice is going to have on the Donnelly and Braun race.
Initially, there was a poll that came out several weeks ago now, but by the Trafalgar Group, that said that although Donnelly's support actually went down regardless of what he did, he was better off if he voted against Kavanaugh than if he voted for Kavanaugh. And there are a couple of reasons for that, but I think perhaps the most important one is that because Donnelly himself cast himself as a moderate, and if you look at his voting record, is a pretty moderate member of the Senate, there were plenty of people of the liberal persuasion who actually were not particularly excited by him. And while they might vote for him when they got to the polls, they weren't necessarily going to go out and do anything on his behalf, knock on doors or do anything like that. But when it came to Kavanaugh, if he did actually side with them, quote-unquote side with them, that was actually viewed as a really good thing and a way to energize that part of the base that was probably never going to get too excited about him. And so in many respects, the argument was, if you have to vote, you might as well vote the way that has a political benefit to you or electoral benefit to you. That's a little cynical. It could be that he actually just believes that Kavanaugh is not the right person for the court, and that we shouldn't rule that out and just assume that he's made his decision for political reasons.
Well, I was going to say, do you think that we're going to see then a new dynamic here when the ad campaigns pick up because of this vote over the weekend? And we know we'll see a lot, you all at least, in being in Fort Wayne and, of course, in the south part of the state in Indianapolis and other points south of us, we'll see many more commercials on television about it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to think about moving to the Northwest area so they don't have to see the commercials, quite
frankly. That's right. That's true. You never see hardly any Joe Donnelly unless it happens to be on the cable. Unless you have it on cable, that'd be the only chance that we'd probably get to see it.
Right. But the reality is we will see this come up, and the question is, what does it really do? And here's what I mean by that. If you, and I'm sure plenty of the listeners have, over the last couple of weeks, we actually saw a shift in the enthusiasm that Republican voters had for this election. And that was spurred on in part because of the Kavanaugh nomination process. Now, technically, voting does start this week, and so there are people who could be rallied to go to the polls immediately, but Election Day is still basically a month away, mm-hmm. and that could mean that the enthusiasm has an opportunity to wane. And what we might see is an awful lot of pushing of voters to go to the polls right now to take advantage of that enthusiasm that was created by the nomination process. And certainly, even all the way up to Election Day, I think we can expect to see and hear commercials that talk about Donnelly's vote and how it was the wrong thing for the country or the right thing for the country. And in many respects, the two candidates kind of wishing they probably could be talking about something other than Supreme Court nomination.
Now we know we have the first of the two debates coming up for the U.S. Senate race this evening, the first one being at Purdue University North Central's campus Purdue University Northwest, the campus in Westville, and that's coming up this evening at 6 o'clock. We'll have it on the air. We know that this probably will be one of the points they'll talk about, the Kavanaugh decision, but I'm sure they're going to talk about, try and mix a few other things in, and I know that it seems that Libertarian Brenton will probably chime in as well on things like health care, won't she?
Oh, she will. And actually, let's face it, the debate would be wrong if it did not bring up this issue. And in some respects, if I were the one moderating it, I would say, let's just take care of this question right away, boom, be done with it, and then get to spend the rest of the time on the other things. But let's remember, Lucy Brenton can comment on the Supreme Court nomination as well, but the other things are where they probably would rather spend more of their time. In the Supreme Court nomination, Braun has an issue that he's going to want to and should play on because he believes that is to his benefit. And given the conservative nature of the state, voters probably would prefer a conservative jurist over a more liberal one or even a moderate one. And Donnelly will want his opportunity to explain his decision because he's been doing this all along. He, for example, voted against Betsy DeVos, but he can explain why he voted against Betsy DeVos. He needs time and wants time to explain that to people. And if the explanation is a viable one, then people fall back on all of the other stuff. The people who are hardcore with one of the candidates because of the vote, their minds aren't probably going to be changed by the rest of the debate. It's that mass of voters in the middle for whom the Supreme Court nomination was an issue, not the issue, who they will be talking to tonight. And that means talking about things like health care, like tax policy, like national defense, like terrorism, like infrastructure.
We only have about a minute left here in our conversation today, Andy, but let's catch up on some of the other things. Are there any other races that we should take a look at in the midterms here around in Indiana that may come up? That besides, we know the big one in front of us all, with the Senate race.
That's the big one, and obviously the one that people look to after that would be U.S. House of Representatives. And you all can look just a little bit to the east. I can look a little bit to the west, to the 2nd District, and see one there that's looking like it's going to be pretty darn exciting. We have one here in the northeastern part of the state, in the 3rd District, where the Democratic candidate has managed to raise a whole lot of money, and the Republican is obviously taking the race seriously and actually running commercials challenging the Democratic candidate. There's some outside money being spent here as well. And then finally, the last House race would be the one down in the southeastern part of the state, down the 9th district, also one that people might say is surprisingly competitive this time around.
Well, Andy, we're out of time for today, but we will get back together again here in the next couple weeks or so and see if there are any updates. I'm sure there will be. And by that time, we won't be to that second senatorial debate just yet, but it's coming ahead. I'm not too. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Andy Downs is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. Time for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Bonnie Johnson, who, along with her husband, created Beatniks on Conkey in Hammond. And how long ago did you start Beatniks on Conkey?
Actually, this past January, we celebrated our 10th anniversary there.
Wow.
So 10 years, yes.
And you've been enjoying it, apparently.
We love it.
Yeah.
It's not like a huge moneymaker for us, obviously.
How many shows do you do a year?
Beatniks itself does two variety shows that we create.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Bernstein is the one that directs those.
Okay.
And it was her thought to do that, so as kind of a fundraiser for Beatniks, so that we could raise money just to even stay alive, you
mm-hmm.
know, especially in those early years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Beatniks does two play productions during
mm-hmm.
the year.
Okay.
But we also have other theaters that use the space.
I see. So
Hammond
it's both
Community
a space
Theater.
And a separate
yes.
Organization
yes.
or company.
Right, right.
Theater company.
Hammond Community Theater also uses the space, and they put on a couple of plays a year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we offer other things there as well, as music, variety shows,
mm-hmm.
you know, one-person shows.
Comedy.
Things, comedy
stand-up.
Nights, yes. You know, we have improv classes there. We
mm-hmm.
have tap dancing classes. And so a lot of different people put their efforts out to,
yeah.
to you know,
it
keep
sounds
the
like
facility
you have
used.
A lot going on.
We do. We're busy.
And do you have refreshments at the for the shows?
We do. Just a few years ago, we opened up our lobby area,
uh-huh.
and that's where we have the tap dances and
uh-huh.
things like that on that side. But we serve refreshments there during intermission.
Uh-huh.
So it's wonderful. They're free.
Mm-hmm.
We have coffee, punch, snacks, things like that that people can enjoy during
uh-huh.
those intermissions.
Good.
Yeah.
So you're what entity is putting on Miracle Worker?
Beatniks
okay.
Entertainment
okay.
is putting that on. Yes.
And that opens when?
It opens on the 12th of October
mm-hmm.
and runs through the 28th. So there's three weekends, Fridays and Saturdays. We're doing that at 7:30, and Sundays are at 2:00.
And Miracle Worker is the story of Helen Keller.
It is. Thank you for knowing that. A couple of people that I've talked to, they
uh-huh.
went, I don't know that one.
Well, like, if you were alive in the 60s, isn't that when the movie came out with,
yeah,
with
Patty
Bancroft?
Duke.
Patty Duke and
yep.
Anne Bancroft.
Yep.
And Anne Bancroft got an Academy Award for it.
I think so, and I think Patty Duke might have too.
Did she?
As well. Yeah.
Oh yeah, of course, because she didn't get it for Valley of the Dolls.
No, no.
I had this most startling. I didn't remember. I did not remember this at all. But when I, in 1976, I was working at a summer theater company in Ohio, in rural Ohio, and I'd had a couple of leads in Godspell and in a Neil Simon play called God's Favorite.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't know was that I was also in The Miracle Worker. What did I play? I was, oh yes, you were so good as that little boy. I was a little black slave boy.
Okay.
I am
yeah.
about the last person on earth who would ever, I mean, you hear about, you know, racially diverse casting where people who are not Caucasian play
right.
traditional Tiny Tim or whatever.
Correct.
I, the whitest human being alive, played a little black slave boy. And Helen Keller can finally speak. It's the scene where she drags
right.
this kid out of bed.
Right, exactly.
I
yeah.
have no
It's
no
a great scene.
Yeah, it is,
great
I guess.
Scene. And you were magnificent.
I was just told this last spring that I had played that part.
Oh, you must have been pretty small then when you did that.
I was 21 years old. I was.
When you played that?
In 1976, I had just graduated from college, so I was 21 or 22.
And you don't remember? How could you not remember
it
that?
It was the 70s. I don't.
That was a rough year, apparently.
I don't know. Anyway,
we have a wonderful cast that's playing. The girl that's playing Helen is Delaney Craig, and she was up for a nomination last year with Nedif for Wait Until Dark. She was excellent in. So we wanted to put this show on. First of all, it's a wonderful show, and it's very heartwarming, and we wanted to find another show that we could get Delaney in if we possibly could, because she's an excellent actress.
Well, fantastic.
Yeah.
And who's playing the Anne Bancroft? What is that lady's name? I can't think of it.
Annie Sullivan. And we have Lindsay McDermott playing that, and she actually won for Wait Until Dark last year.
Wow.
And our show won Wait Until Dark.
That was your production.
Our production
Fantastic.
Last year.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. We were very proud of it. Everybody in the cast did a fantastic job.
Oh, that's so cool. I haven't been to those awards for a long time, but for a while they had them at the Arts Center where I work in Munster.
They're always changing locations now. It's not always the same place. So, but that's good. I mean, it kind of moves it around and lets people, you know, that maybe it was too far to get to before now can go there, you know,
well,
so it's good.
This is great. I'm glad to be able to talk about The Miracle Worker after
all these years.
And good luck with the production.
Thank you so much for having us on.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And if you missed any part of this conversation, you can join John Kane for Eye on the Arts on All Things Considered this afternoon, or join us here on Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation on Regionally Speaking. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.